But basically what we're going to do today, once Ben hops on, is that Ben has admitted something that I think a lot of people have admitted, which is that this season has kind of felt like a slog, this, you know, given everything that has gone on in the world, given some of the density of games, given the health and safety protocols, all the injuries. So we're just going to try to help Ben rediscover his love for this season right in time for the playoffs to start. We're going to talk about some things that we have really enjoyed and try to share Ben and sell him on the stuff that we've enjoyed so that he can enjoy that stuff too, help him appreciate some of the finer things, because this has been a hard year for everyone. This has been a tricky NBA year in a lot of ways. So I've got a lot of things listed, and Ben will hopefully be here soon and we can start talking through them. We'll give him a couple minutes. If he's running late, we can just get this thing going. But this is where to go. I know we have a couple people who have sent in stuff on Twitter as well. So it can be a player. It can be really anything connected to the game this year, anything connected to the sport, just anything that's like, you know what? This is a thing that's helped me forget about like some of the other stuff that's happening in the world. So we're going to talk about that. And as a way of talking about some of these other things, I'm sure there will be a lot of things that people have in common. But, you know, look, help people kind of remind us, like, what's so great about this? Why is this such a joyous thing, a fun thing? Anyway, I'm going to give Ben another couple minutes. But I see some people have already listed some things in the comments. If you hear, list a few others, feel free to jump on and talk through it. Okay. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Mike.
Yo,
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I don't know why I can't hear you through my headphones. Hold on. That's so strange. How are you, Ben?
I'm good. I'm hanging in there, Mike. I'm fresh off of vacation. I had a couple days off of work, which was nice. I managed to not watch any of the Sixers Bucks weekend. I guess there were some, they call them basketball games, and
probably a smart decision. Yeah.
I timed my trip to Joshua Tree to coincide with Doc giving the entire Sixers starting lineup a bunch of days off, but while also maintaining the ability to not give any of them actual rest. So it was good.
So this is the bitter state of mind that you're in right now about the NBA. Hey, welcome back to everyone to Limited Upside Podcast Live Chat. And as I mentioned earlier, before we went live, this is what we're going to do today. Ben, you seem a little down about basketball. Is that safe to say?
It's a fair assumption.
Yeah. Yeah. Why are you down about basketball before we talk about ways to cheer you up?
Sure. So a few things. It's not one particular reason. It's sort of like the cumulative effects of what feels like one really, really long season. You would call it the 2019 to 2021 season of basketball, which I feel like has taken its effects in a number of ways, both, you know, injuries, quality of play, tanking out of control, resting of players, which goes hand in hand with injuries because you can't have both. You're either okay with teams giving, you know, the front end of a back-to-back off to essentially healthy 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds, and you're also, you know, have to be fully aware of the rampant amount of severe injuries that we've seen this year. So I guess a lot of things have kind of gotten into my head as a Sixers fan who also watches an exceptional amount of the rest of the league. You know, you want to tune in to see your top players play. You haven't gotten as much of that in head-to-head star matchups. And then a lot of this comes down to the way that the Sixers have made me feel this season, which is both a lot of positive reinforcement from seeing Joel kind of take another step and Ben keep progressing as one of the more dominant defensive players in the league with his limited capabilities in certain parts of the game. But ultimately, I think he's been a plus this year. But mixing all this together to say that it feels like the Sixers season hit a wall a couple weeks ago where now I have to wait a few months for meaningful basketball. And that's probably the same way that about six or seven teams feel right now. And then there's the five or six teams that are purposely trying to lose every single game. And then there's the jockeying for position that doesn't really matter anymore, because it's not like you have to be the 8 seed, because now the positional jockeying is for the 10 seed, which gives even more wiggle room for more teams to take games off and to not care. And so what I've gotten to is this kind of malaise of fandom, which I feel like I'm getting from the malaise that the players in the league have kind of fallen into. And that's kind of why I'm down, Mike. Is that fair to assume that, or say that I kind of summed up what we talked about pre-pod there?
I mean, I think so. Is there anything else that gets you down? That seems like a pretty long list.
Yeah, just an airing of grievances here. Yeah, I mean, like, look, that all comes together here, which is to say that I think the league has had some really bright spots this year. Look, getting Steph Curry back into the mix is undeniably good for the sport, and it's fun.
Yes, you know, we will talk about a thing that's certainly a thing that a lot of people found joy in this year, and we will talk about that.
Absolutely, and I for one have found an incredible amount of joy watching Steph play. It's impossible not to. I feel like there's some players who we've missed. You know, even his counterpart with Clay, we've missed. We've yet to see the full Nets team really play together, which will be an interesting subplot of the playoffs.
There's
just a lot of things. I feel for Jamal Murray, but at the same time, like, no one went harder in the bubble than Jamal Murray. So is there an expectation that his body would wear down quicker this season? Probably. So some of this stuff feels like avoidable or things that we would consider like obvious, and that kind of sucks too. So that's so, what I'm at, Mike.
I see. Well, it looks like we've got a special guest joining in who has made a speaker request. You may have heard of him. Nate, are you there? Nate, what's up? Nate, can you hear me?
Unmute him, Mike.
Yeah, nah, here we go.
There we go. You're the one with the mic problems this time. How's that?
It wouldn't be the first time.
All right. So, Nate, what's up, man? How you doing?
Good. I was just I'm trying out the Android app. Just installed it, saw you guys were on, so I figured I would jump in and share in the glow of Washington Wizards optimism that no doubt is permeating this room.
You know, it's funny. I listed about like 20 things that made me happy about this NBA season just now before I'm getting ready for the show. And I think around number 18, I was like, you know, I really should have a Wizards one on here, shouldn't I? I mean, it's been really fun. And then I like couldn't figure out what I wanted to put on. So I think that says more about me than anything else about the confusion of how happy should I feel about this team right now. But I mean, look, winning is better than losing. I'll give you guys that. It's better to win games than lose games. And that game last night with San Antonio, great game. Loved it. Didn't care that they lost. I mean, I cared a little, but that was a great game. Great game. I don't know. Like, I mean, it's fun, but like, I'm just so tired of hearing about Russell Westbrook and triple doubles. How do you Thunder fans do this? Have to hear about this all the time. I don't understand.
Well, but he was good back then, though.
He's been good for about 4 weeks.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Four weeks.
Yeah, you may have heard he's as one of the best clutch shooting records in the NBA as well.
And that will certainly continue forever. I did see that. Yes, that was true in his MVP season too, right? I mean, that was one of the big cases for him.
Yeah, that's why Danny and I decided to pick him eventually, because I mean, I think they won probably 5 or 6 games more than expected, and he had all these games where he would just score their last 14 points in a row and everyone else would just play defense and never touch the ball.
The perfect Russ scenario. Now, in all seriousness, I will say my frustration with him watching with the Wizards is one part due to the hanging on to past glory that the franchise and the broadcast team and all this just seems to be doing that is kind of annoying. But the other reason is just that, like, he didn't seem to realize that his game was different. You know, he didn't seem to realize that there are so many ways that he could affect the game without being 2017 Russell Westbrook. He was trying to recapture that glory. And I think recently he's running a lot less sort of straight pick and roll. He's kind of focusing a lot more on beating his own man and then kicking out. He seems to be trying harder on defense. he seems to understand that when he dives to the rim, people are still scared of him, even when they maybe shouldn't be. And now he's playing well more within himself, and lo and behold, they're playing better. So I have enjoyed that part of the Russell Westbrook experience.
Yeah, you know, I think that's interesting, that observation that he's going by guys one-on-one more, because, yeah, when you get him into pick and roll, every team is going to just play a drop coverage on him at this point, if they're sane. And yeah. So that now you're just asking for him to take that mid-ranger that, for whatever reason, he just the last 3 years has just completely abandoned him. So yeah, blow by your guy, and then you're forcing help in a less disciplined way than you would if it's just a pick and roll, and then he can kick out and set guys up a little easier. That makes a lot of sense.
And it's what Houston did last year too with him when he had a good second half. Once they went to small ball, that was basically the role he played. He didn't run a lot of pick and roll. I think it's almost best to think of him less as a point guard now and more as just a totally different position.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what they did in Houston. I mean, he's really, honestly, the two players that I think he's most similar to in the NBA are Zion and Giannis, other than, you know, the fact that he's 6'3", but he kind of is playing similarly to those guys in terms of really what his role should be, like getting to the rim, pushing in transition, shooting fewer jumpers. He's actually over 30% from three, which is higher than he's been recently.
I feel like his shot looks a little better too. It looks a little more less choppy. I don't know. I'd have to look at it a little bit closer, but it does seem like his actual shooting form has improved in a way. But Ben, have you enjoyed Russell Westbrook recently, or are you sort of with me? I always say that Russell Westbrook is more fun when he's not playing for your favorite team, because you get to enjoy all the highs of Russell Westbrook without all the lows. But have you enjoyed Russell Westbrook this year?
Yeah, I think the analogy I would use is like the less you watch, the more you like, which is probably what you're getting at. But I've always been a big Russ fan. You know this, Mike, and stemming from the days of working with him in 2008 in Los Angeles when he was a young kid, to be honest, and seeing him progress. But I will tell you this, as a Sixers fan and as someone maybe with a top seed in the East, I don't know if I really want to run into like a buzzsaw type Russ playing at a peak level come playoff time, because again, so much of this is going to come to how teams are playing who have been striving for a playoff spot for two straight months versus teams who have been essentially non-jockeying for position, which is going to be the East. Are 8-1 matchups, you know, generally predictable? Absolutely. But it's a pretty unpredictable season, and Russ seems to have, I don't know if the term is a chip or a mountain on his shoulder, but you could say that he's carrying some post-game press conference fodder every single night now. It feels like every game is a personal attack on his legacy.
Who's attacking him, though? Other than Stephen A. Smith, like
me.
Okay.
Not that he gives a shit about me, but
he's not Rick Carlisle or Anthony Edwards. But yeah, I mean, just the Wizards, it's all love fest watching their broadcasts and watching their team. They couldn't stop praising him. It's like, see, he's like a Greek god to them. Anyway, these are things that I should be happy about. Nate, is there anything else you're happy about? Sorry to cut you off.
Yes, yes. I was gonna answer the question of the show here before I had to take off. I mean, this is the de rigueur answer, especially living in the Bay. But seeing Steph Curry this year in every game has been must watch TV for me. And I'm the only thing that it reminds me of is how much Kevin Durant signing with the Warriors kind of robbed us of seeing this for the last 5 years. And maybe he wouldn't have been able to hold up for this entire time. But instead of getting those two dominant Warriors seasons with KD that frankly weren't that exciting, to just have had Steph have to carry that team and see whether they could have come back with the same group to get redemption for 2016 and have Steph just breaking barriers, pushing himself to know that he has to take these crazy shots all the time. He's doing this at 33. To imagine what he could have done from, you know, 28 to 32 without KD there. And even last year too, with the broken hand, missing that. I feel like we missed out, but this is one of the best age 33 seasons anyone has ever had that we're seeing right now.
Ben, you're into the stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. I think Steph is the number one answer for NBA joy, both from neutrals or Bay Area folks, Warriors fans, fans of, you know, again, the sport in general. It's almost impossible not to kind of recognize. I know I found myself, I guess, for the last few weeks specifically when the Warriors had a run of games or on national TV here. I live in LA and I have enough blackout coverage of Los Angeles basketball that I don't have to watch much Clippers or Lakers if I don't feel like it. And becoming sort of like a regional sports fan here where there are plenty of Warriors fans here in Los Angeles. It's been nice. Like, I'll tell you this. The one thing about Steph that is undeniable from a joy perspective is you do not see anyone else do anything that he does, right? So it's not
like, oh, yeah,
you know, that specific standout relationship to just shooting a ball better than anyone has ever done that and taking chances on shots that you just can't even fathom. Denzel Valentine, he tried a couple nights ago. to much chagrin
I actually have a controversial opinion. I don't think that was a bad shot, honestly.
Ooh, like down,
he was open. He just hit three in a row. They're down five with 50 seconds left. You need to get a 2-for-1. Like you want to shoot quickly. The other team, like, you have to get a three there, down five with basically two possessions left. I mean, I know it was really ugly because he missed it incredibly badly, and you know that's not his real place on the team. He's like their 12th man, 11th man. But like, that's actually, I mean, maybe not him taking that shot, but that's like a shot that I think was, when you're already in a desperate situation like that, if you're open for three, even if it's a couple feet further than you might like, obviously when you airball it like that, you're going to look like an idiot. But I don't think the process behind that was like so terrible. It'd be nice if he hit the rim though.
Yeah, that's fair. No, that is actually, you know, all things being considered, you're right. It probably wasn't the worst situational shot, but in terms of outcome and result.
Sorry, I gotta cut you off because of Matt's comment. Unfortunately, Denzel Valentine is closer to the Bulls' eighth man.
Yeah, I guess with their current injury concerns, that's
yeah, yeah. So real quick before we move on to other stuff, and Nate, it's awesome to hear from you. What's funny? I think this year has helped me understand and fully appreciate again that Steph Curry is one of a kind, because I think it is very easy to lose sight of describing him flatly as just like this guy that's like this incredible shooter. And he's so much more than that. And it's been interesting, like, kind of, I think, was it one of you two was saying that he's like a show that is different than anyone else in the league. And like, for a while, I was kind of wondering if like more people were becoming like Steph. And now it's like, there's so much more to what he does that is different and is in its own experience. Like, there's something about the way that he can do what he does from any spot on the floor in any situation with any movement pattern that is unique, that is just kind of, you never really know exactly what to expect, even though you expect him to make a lot of threes.
Yeah, I mean, completely agree. Yeah, so go ahead, Nate.
That's the crazy part is, like, you know, he still finds ways to get these shots off, even though everyone has seen him hit these ridiculous shots before. Like, they still just, it still breaks defenders' basketball brains when he takes some of these that they relax a little bit. And even when they're hypervigilant, you just can't. I mean, that's one of the biggest things about Steph, I think, that people don't appreciate, is he's absolutely relentless, right? Like, you don't really think about that kind of a word with him, but he's always running. He's always moving. He's in better shape than his opponents. I mean, he's running around. They got four different guys guarding him throughout the course of the game, and he's still outrunning these guys. And you can't stay that vigilant. There are very few guys who can stay that vigilant, and at a team level in particular, staying that vigilant over the course of an entire game. Like the Kings, I thought they did a great job on him in the first half on Sunday, and he still had 23 points. In the first half, he was 5 of 6 from three. And, you know, I would say on 90% of the possessions, they were doing an awesome job. They were topsided and they're denying him coming off the screens. And you just have lapses on 10% of your possessions, and the guy's got 23 points at halftime.
It's amazing.
It's crazy. Yeah, and I think this year has kind of reminded us about stuff like you were saying. And I mean, clearly, I think there's no argument whatsoever about him being one of the top three players of the last 10 years. And maybe, you know, between him and KD, I think that there's a very legitimate argument. They both kind of missed time. KD was maybe a little bit better in those years in the finals, but Steph was probably better in the other playoffs.
Not LeBron.
When they were together. Well, LeBron is number one, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah, so I'm saying between Steph and KD for number two over the last, like, 10 years or so. But yeah, I'll let you guys get back to your show here, but just wanted to drop in and say hi. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for coming on, bud. All right. We have another speaker request. Ian, what's up?
How's it going?
What's up?
So I had just a general question about players that we give up on too early, and usually like older players. So I mean, Rondo, for example, Dwayne Dedman, Trevor Ariza. These are just a couple examples that are coming to my mind. I know Rondo they lost to the to Wenyen Gabriel and the Pelicans yesterday. But aside from that, like, he's had a phenomenal impact on the Clippers, and I feel like it just speaks to this point that, like, players, older players, if they're in, like, the wrong setting, can just get miscast as being washed. I don't know if that's just, like, a very meta point, but I don't know if you've thought of that, like, specifically this year with those types of players.
Ben, what do you think? Do you enjoy watching? Yeah.
I think it's easier for older players to turn off a team when they see that the recipe isn't there for success and that they might be wasting what is a much smaller window of opportunity for what they have left physically and mentally. You know, you watch players check out in specific situations where then they look much better after a buyout or, you know, after a trade where they are, you know, a more pivotal part in a smaller, in smaller amounts, but are more potent for what they can provide to a team. And I think Rondo is obviously a great example of that with the last two seasons of, you know, essentially becoming a star playoff contributor for the Lakers and then leading to, you know, whatever, 6-7 straight wins, whatever it was, for the Clippers, and being, you know, an integral part. But what, you know, what can Rondo really do with even the Hawks, who aren't a bad team at all, but when he has multiple other young guards, at least one, and then Goodwin's obviously going to try to get some minutes in there, it makes sense that he would kind of see himself in a more minimal role. But, you know, it's weird. I think it's funny to think of guys who have had long careers as kind of being shortchanged for the last part of their career in terms of being able to have their value maximized. But I do think there's something to be said for that kind of veteran contract that ends up paying, you know, far over the dividends of what you've put in financially and what you get out from a player standpoint. Rondo being, again, a great example. I think Dwight Howard's been a great one, you know, single year, single season contract player now for a couple of years, both with the Lakers and Sixers. And there are plenty of other examples, but it's so much of it comes from the star, even Carmelo Anthony right now, to a degree, like realizing, or star or older player, realizing what they can do best for a team. And most guys don't do that. You know, there's a reason why players like Allen Iverson, who could have been a bench scorer in a Lou Williams sense for 10 years, retired at a much younger age. And I think there's just something to be said for the mentality of taking a step back, realizing what type of teammate you can be, what type of contributor you can be, and where you can have the most profound effect on winning, ultimately being the, you know, the success point, not necessarily statistically, but what you can do for the team's wins and losses. And Rondo's always been that incredible cerebral player. He was a role player when he was 22 years old, even though he was an extremely valuable part of the Celtics, you know, championship team. He kind of came into the league built to be the supporting guy in a lot of ways. And so, you know, I think of guys like Tayshaun Prince, you know, as another kind of character in that mold. Shane Battier, who had that kind of, again, became, as he got older, he wasn't the same athletic, you know, defender, but he was an even better team defender. So I don't know, Prada, where is your head at with this?
You know, it's funny, the guy I think about is Blake Griffin, actually, when you think about, like, sort of like kind of a revival star of a veteran former star. I just think it was really sad and depressing watching him in Detroit. And now it's actually been quite fun watching him with the Nets. I think it's a really good fit with his switchability. He seems to have much more in the tank athletically. And he gives him a slightly different dimension. I mean, they don't he's the closest thing they have to someone who can play out of the post, really. And so it's been fun to watch his revival. To the original question, the original question was essentially like, do we shortchange like these guys' ability to change?
As guys get older, I'm talking like kind of like 33 and up, do they just get less of a chance to prove themselves? I'm thinking specifically Dwayne Dedman, who I know is like coming back here and there, but like, I remember when he signed with Sacramento and it just didn't work out that well. Like, he was gone within like that season, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. And I feel like that happens, you know, here and there where we just, a guy doesn't play super well for a short period of time. And then it's kind of like, oh, we're talking about them not being in the league.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, because I think this is one of these cases where I think if you really like went through and like kind of looked at the actual data, I think it's probably accurate to say that old guys tend to get more of a chance in these situations, and maybe less so this year because of the G League bubble has allowed teams to kind of call up players from that spot. But I think you're talking maybe more like kind of reputationally, this sort of feeling that a guy is just washed at a certain point. And to that, I just wonder, like, how much is our own, like, sort of hanging on to past glory at knowing Rajon Rondo's name, knowing Blake Griffin's name, maybe causing us to be a little bit sensitive to, like, sort of whether the degree to which someone is being declared as being washed. Like, the Melo discussion from years ago, it just always bugged me because it was like, I felt like people were arguing against an enemy that wasn't there. Like, in a lot of cases, and still are.
Last thing, Mike, real quick, it's a lot of coaches are also culpable here. Like, a good example is, I hate to keep using the Sixers as a reference point here, but, like, Mike Scott's played more minutes this year than anybody should ever play with the ability level that he brings to the table. He's legitimately bad at pretty much everything that you'd want from a basketball player, but Doc will play him because of his seniority and because he can trust that, I guess he can trust that he knows what he's getting from him. But the Sixers have younger players who could contribute more that aren't going to get that opportunity. And that's where I think coaches, specifically coaches that are just set in their ways with how they view, you know, anyone in their first through third years in the league. And that contributes significantly too.
I mean, look, coaches are risk averse. most people are risk averse, if we're being completely honest, like psychologically, but coaches especially. But yeah, I'm glad you you enjoyed Rajon Rondo. I definitely think there are some cases of guys who are written off too soon. I think Blake Griffin is the guy that comes to mind for me. So thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Coming on. I want to go to Patrick. Patrick, hello. Patrick, are you there?
Hey, Mike, you hear me?
Yeah, what's up?
Hey, man, I'm a Spurs fan, so I just watched that crazy game last night. And I saw your tweet last night that was kind of interesting to me. It was about this idea of, like, just it's nice to see DeRozan just kind of hooping for, like, you know, just, like, a decent team, you know? Mm-hmm. And as, like, a Spurs fan who's, like, under no illusions of kind of, you know, I know we're just, like, an average team, slightly above average team. I have also had like a lot of fun this season, just kind of enjoying DeRozan's game for what it is, without like the kind of pressure of, you know, like, oh, you know, how far does this get you in the playoffs? Like, knowing the answer is not that far.
Right.
But, so I guess my question is, like, for me, DeRozan's one of those players where it's just like his game has so much kind of art and skill to it. It's beautiful. It like sort of reminds me of ballet in a way, the way he kind of, the footwork and the strength combined, it's just really beautiful to watch. So I guess my question is, like, who this season have been like the players for you who aren't necessarily superstars, aren't necessarily kind of, you know, necessarily like kind of have championship equity in that sense. They don't really raise their team ceiling that way, but they just are really fun to watch hoop. I just want to like get some love for those guys. I wonder who those guys are for you this season.
That's a great question, man. I have a lot. It's interesting. Like there's like sort of the category of player like a DeRozan where it's like, this guy is like, DeRozan may be one of, I mean, I guess we can decide whether he's how good he is, but certainly on like kind of offensive talent and his clutch performing. I mean, like certainly recently, what did he say about like a pineapple? I'm a clutch, just a pineapple.
Yeah, he said, what was that? If I'm on an island, if I'm on like an island with another person, I'm going to be the one who finds the pineapple first. Like, a survivor style situation.
I mean, why is a pineapple the thing that's like the fruit of the island?
It's tropical fruit. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but like on that sort of skill level alone, like he may be one of the 15 best players in the game. I mean, I know there's a lot that he's not good at, but I mean, he's at that level. So when you sort of talk about like kind of this guy can be an A1 on like a team that's 500, one of the first guys that comes to mind is frankly the guy that he went against last night, which is Bradley Beal. Hmm. You know, if Bradley Beal is your best player, you're probably about as good as the Wizards are. But, and so there's always this thought that we've got to get Bradley Beal a contender. But if you get Bradley Beal a contender, he's going to have to play a lesser role. And you're going to start kind of harping on the things that he doesn't do well instead of appreciating the things that he does do well. I mean, that guy, the Spurs, like, just could not prevent him from getting to the bucket. Like, it was amazing. Really, yeah, just sort of the moves and the strength that he has and kind of his ability to get open. I think there was one play where they trapped him at half court on a play. And so a lot of times what teams will do is they'll try to give the ball up and give it right back to the star when they're retreating. That's called like a boomerang action, some coaches call it. And I remember the Spurs like did not stop trapping him. They made sure they couldn't do that. So he just went backdoor on both of them and got the bounce pass and scored. Do you remember that play? That was like sometime in over.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of actually at the end of that Celtics game too. He did the same thing.
Yeah.
The Celtics trapped him and then he cut right as soon as he gave the ball up because the defenders kind of relax.
Right, right. If he's playing on a better team, you're not going to see that as often because there's not going to be as much focus to get the ball back. So he's the first guy that comes to mind for me, but there are a number of others. Ben, is there anyone else that you just kind of enjoyed watching play even without worrying about whether they're going to fit in the playoffs or whether, you know, how good are they really? Like, is there another player like that?
That's a good question. Yeah, I tend to wonder, because I'm a big CJ McCollum fan, I tend to wonder if he falls into that bucket of like, how successful can you be if he is your number two, specifically when your number one kind of has the same basketball characteristics. I also kind of wonder, you mentioned Beal, but it's like, is Beal the number one guy on that team? Like, even if he may be their best player, is he the number one player? I don't know. I don't think so.
I'll tell you who the Wizards broadcast thinks is the number one player on that team. Sorry.
There's already way too much Wizards talk on this podcast about NBA joy. It's hard for me to kind of pinpoint players in that specific ilk. I find myself wondering about Paul George a lot because I love watching Paul George. And then I think to myself, well, he's kind of failed out on two different teams for different reasons. And I say failing out in probably not even the right term, but I always wonder like, how great is Paul George? Is he really good? Is he a superstar? Could he ever actually be a number one on a team? Probably not. But I do love watching Paul George play. When he's cooking, he's as smooth as there is. And he makes the game look effortless, like some of the other greatest players in the league.
Yeah, you know, to your Paul George point, like, you remember when he wanted to leave the Pacers because, mm-hmm. you know, they were kind of seemed like they were a dead-end team. The 2 years before he left, like, they didn't have a whole lot around him, and I think that was, like, the best Paul George was. I guess mm-hmm. except for that stint with Oklahoma City at the beginning, in 2019. Yep. But, you know, you almost wonder, like, in a parallel universe, like, what is Paul George's reputation if he just stays there and the Pacers keep winning 45 games a year?
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, he's a good what if for sure. I think it's funny. I think Jimmy Butler had a very interesting character renaissance last year with the Heat. And I wonder sometimes about how we place Jimmy in that pantheon of players. If Jimmy's the best player on your team, you went to the NBA Finals last year in a very weird situation. But I don't know if Jimmy Butler is ever going to taste that type of success again either. And the Heat have struggled immensely this year, and there's a wearing effect on teammates that Jimmy provides that's pretty well documented, but you could see it manifest itself this year, I believe, with the Heat, as well as the wearing they're playing with almost no offseason.
Been Jimmy, or you think it's more like just all the injuries and the fact they haven't had any rest?
I think I was saying the wear and tear of having no offseason, that's one thing you have to qualify with basically everything right now for team. Like, look at Denver, went through about a week and a half spell. Obviously, they had an injury with Murray. They've had Monte, what's his name?
Monte Morris.
Morris with his injury, and now
Will Barton. Another,
Will Barton, sorry. Yeah, just, there's so many injuries, it's hard for me to keep track. Lost Will Barton just now. And so you have to see a lot of replacement players essentially come and fill voids. But yeah, it's hard to, you have to qualify everything with, there was almost no offseason. Even the offseason that was had was in during COVID. So training was different. Almost no preseason. You know, acclimation with rookies was significantly shorter. All those things. And so I think Jimmy Butler is just one of those guys who, he's really good at controlling his own narrative, to his credit. Probably better than most, because he's kind of an interesting guy. He sort of finds himself in conversations that maybe he shouldn't be in. Like, we had him, people were seriously talking about doing about, like, if he was a top five player in the NBA.
Can you tell that Ben is a Sixers fan? Can you guys tell?
I have no idea. I think Jimmy is one of, like, the 15 best players in the league and has been for years. But that's, like, you know, would you rather have Paul George or Jimmy Butler, Mike?
I don't know. I'd probably Jimmy Butler, but I'm not entirely sure. You know, to this original question of, like, kind of guys who we sort of just enjoy for what they are and for who they are. I mean, you mentioned McCollum. I mean, this sort of is Damian Lillard's lot in life, is it not?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's probably a good point. You know, that's fair. I wonder with Lillard, man. What do you, I wonder what the elasticity of his emotional state is, right? Like, how much failure, in theory, or how much mediocrity can he withstand as he sees himself, and probably rightfully so, as one of the best players in the NBA, with a peer set of guys succeeding on teams that are better, and he's kind of stuck in this good but not great team that isn't necessarily built well around him, where his secondary player doesn't even really complement his own skill set. I'm curious what you think about the long-term effects that's going to have and what his long-term kind of prognosis is, because, you know, Lillard is definitely one of the best players in the league. And I think with a really dominant big, or, you know, bigger wing player that he can be, you know, as his number two, or even the number one with which he can be more of the supporting star for, I wonder what his, you know, arc could be.
Well, it's going to be a test of that, that's for sure. I mean, this the end of this season, because that team's not going anywhere. Back to Patrick's original question. Yep. You know, one other guy that I've really enjoyed this year, just for who he is Terry Rozier.
Yeah,
another guy, which is like, man, when he was with his old team, we were always kind of wondering, like, God, what is he bad at? And now he can kind of just be what he's good at, with, like, kind of free of expectations. Like, he's another one that I've kind of really enjoyed. I don't know, Patrick, if you have any others, but I think there actually have been a lot of these types of kind of, one of the nice things about, I think, the season and Kendi that we don't do a good enough job with, is that there are types, guys like this all around the league. And we just have to learn to accept that they're in a season, really any season, there are going to be some teams who finish 41-41 and are led by DeMar DeRozan and play kind of nice basketball, but are probably going to be the seventh seed at best. And, like, that's okay. And that's that, there's a lot of joy that those guys bring on a night to night basis, particularly for their fan base. And there's a lot of, if they're not, like, as good as the best guys in the best teams, like, okay.
Sure.
But there's still a lot to kind of like about them. And I like the comparison, Patrick, you made about ballet. I mean, DeRozan is like watching, like, a dancer a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Thanks. I mean, the only thing I was going to add is, I think it's, like, actually pretty vital for, like, a healthy NBA ecosystem to have these guys sort of in the middle who are, like, technically mediocre, you know, in the sense just, like, yeah, in the larger sense, but just, like, so kind of fun to watch and for the superstars to kind of go up against. And, like, the concept of a duel, I think, is really important for the NBA. The other thing I was just going to say is that the three guys who I would, like, I don't want to put caps on young guys' ceilings, but I would project out for this to be their lot in life is, I think, LaVine has blown up this year.
Oh, yeah, that's another good one.
Probably be his case. I think Randall has been really fun to watch with what he can do at his size. But I don't want, you know, obviously he's about to have a lot of pressure and expectations in New York and everything. But and then also Mitchell, I think, will be a guy. Obviously, he's on an elite team right now. But looking at how his career will kind of project out, I really love his game. I love like the weird baseball passes, what he can do at his size, his strength. I think he's going to be really fun to watch, despite maybe not being that kind of top 10, 15 guy.
Yeah, yeah. I like the LaVine answer for sure. I think the other two, unfortunately, they've started to taste a little bit too much expectations, where like there is a backlash that's coming that I'm not looking forward to. Yeah, I'm worried. I got to say, like, I'm excited for Knicks fans. Like, I'm glad that their team is good and relevant. I really hope that the organization doesn't go too crazy and then this boomerangs right back on them, and that the fan base doesn't get too excited, because if Julius Randle has this happened to Pascal Siakam, I think recently, and it's really changed his trajectory and reputation. Like, when you taste that little bit of success, like, and you take a slight step back, it feels like a giant step back. And I don't know. Maybe I'm getting cart before the horse here. But
I think Siakam's a little different, though, right? He was a very good player on an NBA championship team that was perfect for the role that he fulfilled, and then was given a contract that was for a type of player that he isn't. Whereas Julius Randle,
well, he was for a month initially, and that just didn't really happen. He was until the bubble. I don't know. I mean, he did make all NBA. But I understand what you're saying. Like, maybe it's a little different there. Patrick, thank you so much. I've got a couple other folks who want to chat.
Yeah, thank you.
This is a very good question. Thanks, Patrick. And I'd love to know what other people would say to that.
Mike, can I just say real quick on Julius Randle that maybe I'm in the minority here because I have too many friends that are Knicks fans, but I liked Knicks fans more when they were self-loathing than this, like, hey, watch out, Bucks, we're going to get the 3 seed, or like, we're going to be the 2 seed, we're going to win out. And it's like, my God, like, be happy with the incredible season that you're having. Be aware of the ramifications of playing Tibbs ball for too long. And also just appreciate that this has already far exceeded the expectations, because now Knicks fans are getting to it. A little bit cocky, and I
don't know. I have not experienced that with the Knicks fans in my circles. I think they're all mostly pretty realistic, but I'm sure there's there's a subsection that are not. I mean, mostly I worry organizationally that, like, it's just they're gonna start to think that they're closer than they are. And
what organization would tell you that they're going to make the wrong moves?
Yeah. And like, I was, maybe it's just fresh in my head because of the Suns game last night, but Randall had a rough game. He really got a lot of attention, and he's going to get a lot of that coming forward. Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see how he handles that. Billy, what's up?
How you guys doing?
Hey, Billy.
Yeah. So I just kind of on the theme of things we love this season. I'm not really sure I've seen this article, but like, it kind of feels like the year of the big man, with like, obviously Jokic and Embiid are the top two MVP guys, but just like beyond that, well, I mean, just even kind of go down to things like Giannis, Capella, Randall in the East, I mean, whatever you think Durant is, and then in the West, like, Gobert is probably the best player on Utah. Mike, you're well documented over your asinine take that Davis is the best player on the Lakers.
Hey. I only said he was the best player in the NBA for like one. All right, whatever. I can't defend this anymore.
But yeah, no, it's just like, I feel like it's very cool to be a big guy. Like, there's just a bunch of big guys who are allowed to do things that even like maybe 10 years ago, they would have been told like sit your ass in the paint. And now it's like Brook Lopez is spotting up a corner three. Like, Poku's reimagining the sport.
I'm glad you mentioned Poku. Poku is a joy.
Like, even Randall, who, like, at his size, like, I'm not sure, again, like 5 years ago, like, we would have imagined anyone kind of doing what he's doing. I really enjoyed seeing like the variety of big guys and what they've been able to do. And like, let alone Zion, and him reinventing basketball biomechanics in terms of like getting as low as he does, Mike, as you pointed out in some of your newsletters. But yeah, I just like really enjoy kind of the different anti-body shaming that the big men have gone through this year.
It's been fun. Ben, what do you think about, I have a really kind of bigger picture thought about this that I love, but yeah. I want to see what you think about this first.
Sure. Yeah, I'm on board. I think so much of it is defining big men by the how tall they are, and then completely forgetting everything that we knew about what a skill set means. So there's some traditional bigs you threw in there for sure in terms of like rim protector, good at setting screens, being a PNR guy, like your Gobert, like your Capella, who's having a great year for sure. But a lot of those guys we just mentioned have the skill sets that you would have ideally had in your small forward or shooting guards or point guards even for basically the 40 years prior to the last five. And so it's like, it's amazing to see that type of progression, evolution, if you will, of the sport, but it takes specific types of players in any sport and in any position within those sports to then kind of reshift the way the paradigm of what you think a position should be. So yeah, is there a direct correlation between all of the guys who I think earlier in the podcast we talked about Steph Curry being, you know, often imitated but never duplicated? There's probably a direct line between understanding what someone like Anthony Davis brings to the NBA and has and what, you know, Jokic and Embiid have, basically being that they needed to evolve their position, the center position, in order to play in this league of shooting, specifically, you know, I would consider a much more nuanced defensive approach to the game. And so you needed to have these types of evolutionary, you know, freaks almost. And then you see the offshoot being guys like Julius Randle evolve their game year over year to kind of become that next level. You see a guy, I mean, we should bring it up, but like Mike, joy for me this year has come from Zion Williamson. A lot of joy. This, you know, watching him kind of be healthy and fulfill the prophecy of his physical attributes meeting his type of he's a very smart player as well. And so, you know, it's right. Men being tall for sure are having a renaissance, but the skill sets, you can't pin them to any specific position, probably in the history of this game.
Yeah, I mean, what position is Zion Williamson is a really good question. It's a kind of a funny, interesting question. I mean, is he a point guard? Is he kind of you think of him as sort of like a Giannis, but he doesn't play like Giannis. Like, he goes underneath you. So you know what it is? So I'm writing the chapter now in the book about I'm writing a book. For those who don't know, I'm writing a book about the growth of the modern style of play. That's going to, and like kind of a guide to how to understand and appreciate it. It's going to be out sometime in 2022. I'm writing the chapter on positions and just how our understanding of positions has evolved over time. You know, what has changed about them? And one of the things that I think is really interesting about what's happened really this year compared to even a couple of years ago is that positions are no longer defined by size. For most of the NBA's history, it just sort of happened that way. It wasn't intended that way when James Naismith invented the game. By the way, fun fact, James Naismith once advocated for a four-pointer. Bet you didn't know that. James Naismith, the guy who invented the game, once said that he was open to the idea of there being a four-point shot, a four-point shot.
Yeah, he was zigging before you could even zag.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy that invented the game. So, I mean, is he really a zigger or a zagger? It seems like he's – yeah, fun fact. James Naismith, I think, would have loved today's game. I'm just going to say that right up front. But one of the things that's interesting is that the positional spectrum really kind of evolved into a size spectrum. You know, the guard, forward, center. Like, it kind of didn't intend to be that way initially. I mean, at first referred to where you were on the floor. And I think now what's interesting that's happening is that like your position based on like kind of what that position has done, like really has nothing to do with how tall you are, or maybe less so had to do with how tall you are. I mean, you know, Billy, you talk about the big men and kind of redefine themselves with small man skills. I think what's actually been kind of fun to watch has been almost the inverse of that, where we've had some small men that play like big men. Where you mentioned Zion, but I'm even thinking about guys like Bruce Brown with the Nets and kind of that power point type of player. Julius Randle's actually a really good example of this. You know, he's basically he plays a lot like James Harden, but they kind of don't play the same position, yet they kind of do. And just sort of this idea of now you've got kind of spot up big men shooters and like wings that play in the short role and, you know, and power guards, and like a Jay Sean Tate is someone who's come into this league and is like, he's kind of a big guy, but he's not a big guy. He's wide. He's like a wide guy. what position is he? And just sort of redefining like kind of the positional spectrum generally. And like, you know, you mentioned Brook Lopez as well with Milwaukee, with him shooting the ball. The other interesting thing that's happened with Milwaukee is like, again, the inverse of that. Brook Lopez out by the 3-point line, Jrue Holiday and Dante DiVincenzo right around the basket in the dunker spot, just completely inverting that structure. And I just love the freedom and the diversity of style that has resulted. And I think it's an awesome thing. And I don't know why this year I've noticed it more. I think maybe the Lakers title has sort of allowed people to reimagine a world where big men kind of can play in different roles. But I think it's been awesome for the sport, and we were at the risk of perhaps learning the wrong lessons from the size, where it's like, if you're tall, like your position is your skill set now, not your size. We were at the risk of saying, if you're tall, you can't play any position. Now it's just your size just doesn't have anything to do with what position you are. So I love that question. Great question. Thank you so much. We got Ravon. Are you there?
Hi, Mike. Hi, Ben. How are you doing?
Hello. What's up?
Yeah, for me, the things which I'm most happy for is LaMelo Ball and Anthony Edwards. Both are fun in their own way. Anthony is a fun guy. Like, all his quotes are super funny. Like, I think yesterday, they had me on Russell Westbrook court. Wow. Gem.
What do you say about A-Rod, that he hadn't heard of A-Rod?
Yeah. He's like, I don't play baseball and I don't watch MLB, so I didn't know about this guy or something like that. And then he said, wasn't he with J-Lo? They said, no. Oh, I guess he's sad. Hope they get back together or something like that.
Yeah.
And now they're back, actually. I don't know.
Really?
Yeah, so they had a meal that TMZ was able to capture, so who knows?
Wow, a meal.
That
holy
man
shit.
Talks about Popeye's fries and bunch of whole other things, has super confidence. Again, had the dunk of the year.
Yeah.
You guys joked about it at the start of the show, but we are not going there.
Yeah, you're right. He's sort of like, kind of like, has captured that like innocence that, even if it's like sort of feels, it isn't actually innocence. Like there's some sort of like kind of fun, like kind of, what's the generation after millennial? Generation Z, is that it?
Gen Z.
Or isn't there like a, whatever. He sort of has that like kind of innocence about him that is like kind of fun. And as a basketball player, like, I don't know. I think what's most interesting is obviously he's inefficient. He sometimes settles for too many jumpers, but I thought there was some interesting defensive stuff, honestly, that was happening in the Utah series where he was kind of playing as this, like, he has like a football background. He's kind of playing like that kind of QB spy, Mike linebacker. I don't know my football terms. Like, you know what I mean? Like kind of the, what's the position that's like half linebacker, half safety, Ben?
A strong safety?
No, like a more modern strong safety. Like,
I mean, that's the term. You're thinking just of like what a position.
Yeah,
speaking,
yeah.
Some defenses.
It's strong safety, like Cam Chancellor.
Yeah, exactly. Cam Chancellor, Brian Dawkins, guys who get up into the box and play in the nine. You're also, Mike, you're thinking of the defensive strategy of a QB spy, which is usually with the middle linebacker or strong safety, someone with that
right.
type of physical flexibility can play.
I thought that like our old coworker Richard Johnson did a video on this, on like how the third linebacker was becoming like a linebacker safety hybrid. And he had a name for it. I forget what it was called.
It's the Mike linebacker, but that doesn't.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
That's but it.
This is where me being a fan of all sports and my kind of knowing some sports is great. But Mike, I think the thing that Anthony Edwards captures is that he does, to give you another sports parallel, Major League Baseball hates when their young players have personality. They hate it. They can't stand when Tatis Jr. or Acuna smash a home run and then celebrate doing something that's incredibly difficult to do. And basketball embraces that. And I think Anthony Edwards is sort of like that young kind of personality that it doesn't matter if the Wolves are good or not. They're not supposed to be good. But what you want is to see that your young players are enjoying playing. They're not being taken down by losing. And that you're getting that personality from a guy that you kind of feel like you have some kind of relationship to the growth of the young player. And I think he gives that in spades. Like, he's just a really, he seems like a very open book, interesting guy. And, you know, in a league of stars, it can be very conscious of how everyone thinks about them because it's such a public facing sport. I think Edwards is a breath of fresh air. So yes, I think he brings me joy as well.
Yeah. And LaMelo, I think, obvious no reasons doubt. For sure. I hope he's supposed to come back, I believe.
Yeah,
already back.
Yeah, so that's very exciting for sure. And it's like, I mean, the cynical answer here is that, you know, just wait till a publicist gets a hold of him and changes him and into something that he's not. But whatever, I'm not going to go there yet. Love that. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Bino would like to speak. Hello, what's up?
Oh, yes, Bino.
Yes. Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Hello.
How's it going, man? It's one of my best friends here, Mike. This is a.
Oh, okay.
What's up, Mike? You may remember me as the guy who criticized the original Limited Upside JPEG cover. that was like utterly horrendous.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. I agree with you.
So I'm a Celtics fan, and I'll make this short. They brought me no joy, almost absolutely negative joy. So we can totally skip over those jerks. What's really brought me joy, honestly, is just Ja Morant, and I've joined late. And I have him on my fantasy squad, so I've been paying a little extra attention to him. You know, he's definitely. I feel like he's in a little bit of a sophomore season. Did you guys talk Ja already? I'm sorry.
We haven't.
No, we haven't. Okay. No.
So the perfect person. Yeah.
Ja Morant is, even to anybody watching basketball, which like I force my wife to watch an ungodly amount, unfortunately, she notices Ja. Like, he sticks way off the screen as somebody who's just so dynamic. Those passes that go 40 feet from half court, or, you know, whatever they might be. It's really on the passing and then obviously driving to the hoop, how special he is, I think, and how he carries the ball. But I feel like it's shades of, you know, as a point guard, I mean, there's a lot of white chocolate to him. Honestly, I feel like I see a lot of things like that. I mean, maybe not nearly as crafty as he was, but there's a lot of that to him. And it's so fun watching him play. And I'm extremely jealous that he's not on my team.
It's a good chocolate. Yeah. Interesting. Hmm. He kind of has that like burst like Steve Francis back in the day.
Mm. Love Steve Francis. That's a good one too. He's a combination. I mean, I watch Ja's the type of guy, and I'm glad you brought him up too, because like talk about a player helping a team exceed expectations, right? They lost their second best player before the season started. And I guess he just came back from Jaren Jackson Jr. There's no recipe to get Brooks and Kyle Anderson to be your number two and number three. Valanciunas who's, you know, one of those guys who's like a lot younger than people realize, that he's like 26 or 27. Like,
he's 16. Yeah.
The Anthony Melton revival. Memphis got a lot of good players. I like
what
Memphis is a team that's brought me a lot of joy this year in general. They have a lot of really good players.
Can't you tell the difference between a team with low expectations versus a team with high expectations? I mean, that's what I'm, you know, especially as a Celtics fan, coming into the season with high hopes is like Boston's worst thing. Like, it's like the worst thing to happen to the city of Boston or any team to have those kind of pressurized expectations. Just does not bode well.
Yeah.
you know, and our guys are young. And
I was going to say, Boston's interesting too, right? Because it's not like they're being led by guys in their late 20s who, like, this is the time to be at their prime to lead a team. Like, they just had incredible seasons that really, I mean, in Tatum's case, at a very young age, and Brown taking a leap this year, but that not really simultaneously happening with the rest of the team taking the step forward. I can see everything in life is about, right, balancing expectations, you know, against results. And in the case of the Celtics, expectations were very high and the results haven't been there.
And there's no joy. Yeah. And like, if this is the joy podcast, you know, it's not just that, like, as a fan, I'm experiencing no joy. Like, it's pretty obvious that I don't think anybody on the Celtics is enjoying the season whatsoever.
No, I don't think so either.
But you see that in Memphis. You 100% see that in Memphis.
For sure.
Yeah, it's the old Homer Simpson lesson. If the lesson is never try.
That's right.
But it's funny. Ja is, like, incredible to watch in part because I think of his movement. I mean, it's just like his body twists in ways that aren't supposed to twist. He almost feels like...
I'm always surprised by his power. He looks like a skinny marinky-dink kind of guy. Yeah. He looks like he's 120 pounds soaking wet. And when he, like, flies and jams over a dude, it's always surprising to me how much power he has.
It's a great illustration of how strength in the modern NBA is not based on how big your muscles are. I think there's just wiry strength there that's really is key. But the funny thing about Ja is that, like, I think that there are a lot of ways that Memphis has overachieved in spite of him rather than because of him. Not necessarily because he's going to be a bad player down the road, or there isn't like kind of an engine element of it that drives it. But I do think the fact that his shooting has really tanked this year has really hurt
them. Yes, it has. Yep.
And I mean, my theory for that is that when he had that original ankle injury in Brooklyn, do you remember that injury?
I do. Like, looked
really bad.
He missed a couple of weeks. Yeah.
I don't know if that. I think that his feet don't feel balanced when he shoots. Like, I don't think he's been able to plant and rise up as easily, and I think that that has affected his shot. But
and it's only recently that I feel like he's getting it back a little bit. If you look at the numbers, and this is, I'm not looking at the numbers, this is just from memory of managing the dude. He came back very early from that ankle injury.
He did.
Like, yes, everyone was expecting him to be out for a few weeks, and he came back in a week or two. And then, you know, he was putting up these, like, 30 to 40 point games, like, early in the season and towards the end of last season. And then it just really tailed off, to your point. And only recently is he putting together, like, pretty consistent 30 point games.
Yeah, I think that injury set him back more than people realize. But I mean, Memphis is, like, such a great, smart drafting team. Like, everybody they put on the floor, everybody they drafted, like, they make sense in the modern NBA. Like, DeAnthony Melton, Xavier Tillman. I love Xavier Tillman. I can't understand how he fell. Like, he seems like I've been begging my team to have an Xavier Tillman for, like, years. Desmond Bane. Love Desmond Bane. Grayson Allen kind of become a pretty good player there. Mm-hmm. Kyle Anderson is just, like, a super fun joy just because of the different play he has. JV, Justice Winslow coming back. Like, that's kind of been fun, too. I love how they basically become, like, kind of the modern version of what they were with Zach Randolph, Marc Gasol, blah, 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 you know, the modern grit and grind. They just, like, they get into you. And, like, I don't know, I would love to see another Portland-Memphis play-in game. Thought that was terrific. Those two games over the weekend, not great for the Blazers, but yeah. Alec, what's up?
Hey guys, it's been a little bit since I've been on here, but I noticed that you guys were spreading some positivity. I thought it was cool that I'd hop in.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I've loved this season is that I'm a Nets fan, and they've been really, really, really good for the first time in my life.
Yes, that's a pretty good reason to like the season.
Alec, I was going to bring up earlier, as someone who brings me joy, is watching Kyrie Irving play and have fun. I think he gets a lot of because he's an interesting guy who puts himself out there for better or for worse into some types of conversations where he might not have what I would consider points of view that fit inside the box. I think that detracts from how incredible he is at basketball sometimes in the national narrative. And he is unbelievable to watch breakdown play. I mean, I in terms of handle, shot making ability, all those things, I've been loving watching Kyrie play this year because ultimately the only consistent part of the Nets from the three superstars has been Kyrie Irving this year.
Yeah, you could say that. I think you're totally right. And I think one of the most fun parts about Kyrie for me is how mad at myself I can get about his shot selection. Like, I'll see him pull up and I'll be like, oh, that's stupid. And then I'll go and I'm like, oh, I'm stupid. Like, what was I thinking? Like, this is Kyrie Irving.
Yeah.
And it's a nice little jolt of like, no, this isn't like D'Angelo Russell and Spencer Dinwiddie. Like, this is Kyrie Irving. You need to be respectful here.
Yeah, you can tell the difference. Speaking of someone who just his body moves in ways that nobody else's does, I mean, that I'm still amazed. What I remember that clip that Kyrie was basically leaning his entire body all the way onto the ground from his side, and he was using his heels to prop himself back up. Do you remember that video?
Honestly, I don't know what shot you're talking about.
No. It wasn't a basketball video. It was like an exercise video.
Oh, yeah. In the
it's like an optical illusion almost. That's the type of talent he has. Yes.
It's in like a Cleveland workout facility. Yeah.
Was it? Yeah. It's just like, how does a body do that? But Kyrie is going to be an interesting test case for, you know, the Nets in the playoffs. I think it's obvious that they have flaws and they have weak points you can attack. But one of the big challenges, I think, for anyone who plays them, especially without a home crowd, is that psychologically, can you handle playing perfect defense and getting beat over and over and over again? Can you stay disciplined? Can you play your game? And can you kind of stay with the game plan? I think you watched that Phoenix game over the weekend. At a certain point, I think Phoenix just sort of lost it a little bit. And Phoenix is like the most disciplined team in the league right now. Like, they're like, Chris Paul is giving me a lot of joy, but that's a separate conversation. Can you keep up, and can you not let that affect the rest of your game? Because there's nothing you can do. And Kyrie is a really good encapsulation of that, because he takes shots that you want him to take and he makes them. Can you sort of stay in the moment and just kind of keep playing when he's doing that in a playoff setting and you don't have your crowd to kind of pump you up? I just think that's going to be a huge challenge for whoever plays them in a way that.
No, Mike, I completely agree. We saw this in the bubble last year. Shooters shoot better without fans and with the lack of whatever emotional presence, adrenaline moving presence that fans can create. And look, a world where Kyrie Irving, Harden, and KD are on the court together, good luck. You know, good luck to everyone, because all three of them are, you know, impossible shot creator and makers. Mike, I have to go, but I will say this podcast has brought joy to me.
Has it cheered you up? Yes. Mission accomplished. Excellent.
Hearing all of the people call in and give us the opinions of things that have made them happy this year has made me happier. And so I do appreciate all the awesome listeners and call-ins here. Thank you for allowing for this topic to move forward. And it was your idea to cheer me up. So thank you, Mike.
I'm glad you're cheered up. I think we can wrap this thing up, and unless someone's got some more things to bring in joy. I do want to shout out Chris Paul and the Suns. I forget who said it, who tweeted it. I think it was Nate Jones, who was just like, we really aren't spending enough time appreciating how a small guy at his age is doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, like, I just don't think that this just has never happened in the NBA ever. You know, and I don't think we've done enough appreciating of that and just the sort of mastery of the body that he has and the little tricks he does. So I want to shout that out.
Mastery of the game. Just like, man, Chris Paul is the closest thing we have to the apex chess player, the grand champion of you know, the thinking part of the game mixed with, you know, all the right amounts of physicality. I'll tell you this, in a lot of paddle sports, the last thing I'll leave you with, paddle sports, tennis, racquetball, anything like that, you know, squash, the best players move the least. And someone like Chris Paul has mastered the art of making each movement cost more, be more valuable, each thought move the ball and move the game further. And I will tell you that positionally speaking, no one probably in my lifetime has thought the point guard position and executed
that thought process better than Chris Paul. So full appreciation for what he's done.
It's amazing. Great to talk. Yeah, I mean, it's like he does that trick now that I wrote about last year. He does it more often now where he'll, as a way of creating a fast break, he'll kind of get the ball in an outlet, find your opposing big man, kind of basically hide behind him, wait for that guy to basically feel awkward and run out of the way, like set a screen on his own man, like try to escape. Like he'll just sort of occupy that guy from behind, like he's chasing him down. And then as soon as that big guy veers off to find his assignment because he doesn't want to get matched up on Chris Paul, he'll just shoot the three. My favorite move in the league. Noah did have something. Do you have something you want to talk about that you've enjoyed this year?
I was hoping to be able to share it with Ben, but I'll share it here. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, when he was playing, has been an absolute joy to watch. I mean, in terms of this, the way he moves and, like, does his thing, he is a one-of-one. I mean, just he's incredibly unique. I love watching him.
Couldn't agree more. The Thunder loved watching him so much that they shut him down because they were winning too much.
He does have the foot thing.
Yeah, not a lot of details on this foot thing after it first happened. I'm being facetious. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was a real joy. I'm very curious to see his trajectory because he's kind of halfway between a traditional point, like kind of a point guard skill set with like kind of one of those big wing bodies. Very curious. So, yes, couldn't agree more. Anything else you've enjoyed?
I mean, I could go like very in depth on that, but no, I just think, you mentioned this earlier, but the way that positions are kind of gone, like, you know, we have all these small guards being used as bigs. And I mean, just everything is like, I guess, how it should be. You know, skills trump everything else.
Right. So you made a bit of a Freudian slip there that I think is worth noting because you're not the only one who does this. And I think it's like a common misconception and something. You mentioned that sort of positions are gone, right? That was the word you used. Like there are.
Not that, but that, like, you know, roles, like your kind of role on offense and your position, they aren't synonymous in the way that things used to be. Because even though, you know, you have the big initiators, if you look at most starting lineups, like you can, like the heights are kind of, you know, still organized. I just love how, you know, you have, like, for example, a lot of small, like you have Bruce Brown, Terrence Mann, rollers, right. You have Terry Rozier, who's 6'1", but he's like playing entirely off ball. I just love how, you know, guys have been allowed to really like focus in on what they can do regardless of.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, were you around for the Free Darko blog era? No, I don't remember how old you are, but do you remember, were you around for when Free Darko was at its height?
No, my Twitter presence is like 9 months old or so.
Okay. So one of the things that Nathaniel Friedman, Bethlehem Schultz talked about that I think is worth rereading in the context, and I think kind of got a little commandeered, was he didn't talk, you hear the term a lot, like positionalist basketball, right? Like where like kind of everyone can kind of do a lot of different everythings. And what he spoke of was not that, was something called a positional revolution, which is different than positionalist basketball, which is, I don't want to kind of steal his thunder, but I think it's sort of too much. I'm sure you have a more specific designation. But what he envisioned was a world where a player basically determined the shape of their team and his role rather than a coach. And that role was determined, again, not by height, not by orthodoxy, but by sort of that person's skill set. Like, and so then a coach's job would be to kind of mold their skill set into a whole that works for everyone. And so instead of just shuttling them to point guard or center or whatever, at some point, I think this sort of got commandeered a little bit as like this idea of things are positionalist. Like this is the positionalist NBA. And I think the problem with that line of thinking and the problem that I think Nathaniel always had with it, and one that I share, is that positionalists suggest that it's coming from the other frame of mind to call something positionalist. It's positionalist in the sense that it's no longer what the positions were in the same way. And so, but that's not the same thing as saying that positions don't exist or that ways to stratify players don't exist. It just means that the players themselves and their skill set kind of determine the way that they are aligned as a collective. And so then you need to work a little harder and be more creative about like kind of which pieces fit where. So to the point that like Terry Rozier at 6'1" can play like Terry Rozier does. His position is kind of defined more by what he brings to the table. It's a lot different than saying positionalist. Positionalist is kind of, I think, the mistake that Billy Knight's Hawks made, where they just wanted to select a bunch of 6'7" guys who had swing that with a lot of skills. I think that's an important distinction that we need to remember. And one of the things I love about where the NBA is now is that we are kind of going back to something that is more of a positional revolution than a positionalist game. And I think that's awesome. And not the same thing. Does that make sense, Noah?
Yeah, I think what I was trying to say is that roles or like what you have to, you know, look like or how tall you have to be to fill a different role, it doesn't have to be the same from team to team. Like, for example, if you look right. at like Mavs, the guy who's going to, you know, create all the offense, Luka, the guy who's going to, you know, roll to the rim, create that rim pressure, Willie Cauley-Stein or formerly Dwight Powell. Then you look at the Nuggets. They still have a primary initiator and they have guys who, you know, pressure the rim, but the guy pressuring the rim is MPJ and Aaron Gordon on cuts. And the initiator is their center, Nikola Jokic. So, you know, teams still have the same roles. It's just right. anyone can kind of play any role, which I think is cool. Or like, you know, on the Clippers, up to Terrence Mann, he can be some of your rim pressure.
Yeah. And I think that, it's just the positional spectrum, and this is the last thought I'll have before we wrap this up. Like, and this is because I'm writing this chapter now for the book. The positional spectrum is so hardwired that we assume that it's very easy to assume that if it's not that regular positional spectrum, it's positionless, and it's just so easy to slip into that mind frame. And I think to your point, like, it's not like the Mavericks or the Nuggets or these teams just have a bunch of 6'7" guys. Like, they have guys who are different sized. Like, they have to, you know, every team has to. So it's just that perhaps the size doesn't correspond directly to the three position or five position spectrum that we've known our whole lives. And that doesn't mean that things are positionless. It means that the positions themselves are being upended. So that's a, I'm giving a little bit too much away of the book, but I think that's an important distinction to be made. So, Noah, thank you. Everybody else, thank you for joining us, and thank you for cheering Ben up. Really appreciate it. This is a great list. I'm sure, again, we could talk about a whole lot of other things that we enjoyed, but I think we've hit a lot of the ones that I've enjoyed this year, and super awesome discussion. We are probably going to have a real podcast sometime this week. I don't want to give too much away, but we're lining up an actual guest to talk about in an actual podcast and not locker room. So look forward to that. Until next time, we'll be back here at 3 p.m. next Tuesday. And this has been the Limited Upside Live Chat.